Welcome, leaders, to our first mini pod recapping the midterm election results in South Carolina. We're taping this live from the aftermath of the Republican Victory Party, where we just heard from the slate of Republican constitutional officers who were reelected, and Governor Henry McMaster, who was elected to his first term as governor with his running mate, Pamela Evett, the first female lieutenant governor. We're still awaiting results from the competitive first congressional district race between Republican Katie Arrington and Democrat Joe Cunningham. But to break this down for you, we have the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove and the Associated Press's Meg Kennard. Y'all watch the Republican victories here tonight with me, and thank you for sticking around so we could drop this podcast for all you out there listening. Welcome, guys.
Hello.
Thanks, Gavin.
Meg, you've been watching McMaster for years. He was thrilled when he came on stage tonight. And at 71, he has finally fulfilled a lifelong goal of winning this office outright. What struck you in the early results and in his victory speech tonight?
I have known Henry McMaster for a long time, all throughout his time as Attorney General, through his time as Lieutenant Governor. I have never seen him as elated as he was tonight. He was full of emotion, and rightfully so. He has wanted to be governor for a long time. He has sought the office before. He lost the primary in 2010 to Nikki Haley, a very hard-fought race. And tonight, he celebrated. He had his children with him. He had their spouses with him, his wife, Peggy, and all of the people who have served throughout his administration and also were with him, a lot of those same people when he was Attorney General of South Carolina. So Henry McMaster was a happy man tonight, and he has every right to be.
Meg, we did see, and Jamie, I'm going to get to you in a second, but we did see the networks call the race around 7:10. Associated Press didn't call it till about 9:35. This campaign was waiting for that call. We were all waiting for that because AP's de facto when it comes to race calls. What insight do you have on that process? And maybe tell us what you guys were waiting for and waiting until 9:35.
Sure. The Associated Press, as we've talked about on this podcast before, has stringers throughout the state who are calling in data to us, and we're communicating with state officials as well. This year, we also used a new system called VoteCast, which operates similarly to exit polls in the past. We talked to voters before Election Day to get in on some of the early voting decisions that they're making, but also talk to voters at the polls. So today was the first year to use a lot of that data, and we are pleased with the success of it so far, but also wanted to take the time to have actual numbers coming in throughout the state, actual election results that we could use to make that call. The AP always wants to be right, even if that means that we're not necessarily always first.
And we did see back in 2014, when it was just about a minute afterwards, we saw your former colleague who works with the Post and Courier now, Sean Adcox, kind of recount that in 2014, where it was about a minute after 7 o'clock when polls closed that Nikki Haley won her second term. Jamie, right now we're looking at the numbers, and it shows, I think, with the numbers we're looking at right now, 55.8%, Smith at 44.2%. That's, I guess, what, 10, 11 points there. That's kind of right in the middle between 2010 Nikki Haley beating Shaheen at 4% and 2014 Nikki Haley beating Shaheen at 15%. Is this what we were expecting? Is there any surprises in the data and the breakdown across the state that you've seen?
I think it's roughly tracks with more or less what we were expecting. We're a couple points closer than Trump's victory in 2016. But at the end of the day, you know, you just didn't feel like the dynamics out there had fundamentally shifted. This is a conservative state. It is just not really quite as competitive as many other states around the country. James Smith was, as we've talked about for many, many months, the candidate the Democrats had wanted to run for many years. He was a great candidate on paper and had a great resume, and he ran a very disciplined, on-message campaign. But he never really fundamentally surprised anybody or made any major changes to what we expect to see on the ground in South Carolina, and I think that played into Governor McMaster's hands at the end of the day.
You know, we were looking at on Twitter, Rob Godfrey, Nikki Haley's former communications guru, had a really great tweet, great take. If you want to check it out, it's at Rob Godfrey.
Very smart.
And he kind of breaks down the McMaster campaign. He says, you know, McMaster's win was really primarily major due to McMaster being himself and letting his campaign let him be himself. But at the same time, they also his team really did shift focus and actually, you know, spend money appropriately. They actually got that message out better. They had a bruising primary, obviously, when he had to go into a runoff.
Yeah.
you know, we saw this was one of the most expensive, this was the most expensive gubernatorial campaign in South Carolina State's history.
It was. In large part because of the primary. Yeah. I think that should be said. You know, a lot of that money was spent by John Warren, by Catherine Templeton, yep, in a very expensive Republican primary. You know, overall, it did become the most expensive gubernatorial race in South Carolina history. But, you know, I think as Rob pointed out, there were no big earned media hits against Governor McMaster, as in when we talk about earned media, it's, you know, what we all are. We're the reporters. You know, we write about stories that folks are creating in the news. And there were no major news breaks over the course of this campaign that fundamentally shifted the way that this race was seen. And look, you know, South Carolina has a fairly strong economy right now. We have a low unemployment rate, as Governor McMaster likes to talk about all the time. We have record jobs. We have more jobs coming. You know, as Smith pointed out, and his running mate, Mandy Powers Norrell, pointed out, there is more migration to the state than jobs. There is labor participation declining. There are statistics you can point to that suggest the economy is not as strong as Governor McMaster claimed. But at the end of the day, you go around South Carolina, and I think a lot of residents in this state feel like things on the economy are going fairly well right now, and it's very hard as a challenger to come in and create an upset in that kind
of
environment.
And that's something we've kind of talked about. You know, this race will be interesting in a couple of years once we see the ramifications of the president's tariffs affecting South Carolina, because we've already seen some inklings of that. And of course, that takes time to trickle through, and with McMaster being so closely tied to the president, it would be a different race, I'm sure, if these tariffs continue to pinch South Carolina. And I did talk to some people about this, you know, saying, you know, McMaster's doing a good job. I mean, he hasn't rocked the boat, and that, I think, has been his goal for the past 2 years. What do you think, Meg?
Yeah, that's the same thing that I've heard from a lot of voters across the state. You know, they're worried about tariffs. That's one of the issues that's certainly on people's minds. But they're willing to give Governor McMaster a chance.
And to President Trump a chance.
That's right. And to see what the full ramifications of decisions like that one, like offshore drilling, may be. The end is yet to come on either one of those fronts. It takes a long time to implement any big change like that policy-wise. But they're willing to give them both a chance.
Meg, you are still right behind your computer. We're waiting. We still haven't seen a race call for the first congressional district. Like we're saying, again, that's between Katie Arrington, the Republican who defeated Mark Sanford in the primary, and Joe Cunningham. I'm looking at numbers right now. They might be different from what you have, but New York Times shows me with 55% of the precincts reporting down there in the first congressional that Arrington has about a 4-point lead over Joe. Meg, what are you guys waiting for? What are you seeing in this race on your end?
One of the things that we saw in the Charleston area, which is where the first district is, there were very long lines when polls closed. Some people didn't actually get to cast their votes until after 9 p.m. tonight. So waiting for those votes to be counted is something that, particularly in a heavily populated area like Charleston County, we're going to be waiting on before we feel comfortable making a call. As we know, these two candidates, their support centers broke down differently. Joe Cunningham has had a lot of support in the Charleston County area, whereas Katie Arrington has had stronger supports in Beaufort County and some of the other places. So it really does depend on where we see the votes come in for either one of those candidates before we can make that call.
And I can tell you what my colleagues down in Charleston are reporting right now. My colleague Caitlin Byrd is with the Katie Arrington campaign. Their campaign manager says that the unprecedented numbers of absentee ballots are part of the issue that they're kind of waiting to see. There was a glitch in Hilton Head that may be attributing some of the lateness here. And so they are still at this very moment. We're recording at 11:38 p.m. And Katie Arrington is urging her supporters to stay there. They do hope at this point they are going to get a call on this race by the end of tonight. So by the time you hear this podcast, you may
know the results.
Joe Cunningham is still holding out hope. He has arrived at his election night party, and my colleague Chloe Johnson is there with him. So it could still be a late night, and we may well know the results by the morning. It does seem like Katie Arrington at this point is most likely to pull it out in a race that, of course, Republicans always really should have expected to win. You know, they did get worried here towards the end, but this is a district that Trump won by 13, 14 points. It became very close. Joe Cunningham, you know, ran a very competitive campaign against Katie Arrington, but it seems like she is going to pull it out here at the end.
And Jamie, pulling back and looking at the rest of the congressional delegation in the state, obviously the House races that were up, no surprises statewide. I mean, we saw every race go the way we assumed it was going to go, historically would have gone.
Yep, and, you know, know, I mean, the two races we were paying the most attention to, I suppose. William Timmons will join either Arrington or Cunningham as the newest member of the congressional delegation, replacing Trey Gowdy up in the conservative 4th congressional district in the upstate. And then, you know, as we've talked about a lot over the last few months, Ralph Norman ended up pretty comfortably, it seems like, beating Archie Parnell. Archie was considered to be a very strong recruit for the Democratic Party. As we talked about last week, you know, he had those divorce records that we obtained, lost him a lot of official Democratic Party support, lost him support from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and he really struggled to regain momentum in that race after that.
And Jim Clyburn getting his 14th term. I mean, that's going to be something to watch for. Meg, you're nodding your head. I mean, we're going to be watching that speaker's race, right?
That's absolutely right. Exactly. I mean, the Democrats have performed nationally pretty strongly this evening, and so that could be, you know, signifying a change in power. Jim Clyburn has been in Congress for a very long time. He's been in-house leadership for a long time. So absolutely, he is not only South Carolina's only congressional Democrat at the moment. We're still waiting on the first district.
It is 11:40.
But he does have a lot of seniority in the chamber.
You know, Nancy Pelosi was asked today if she, you know, what her position is at this point in the speaker's race. She didn't want to talk about it. She wanted to wait until tomorrow. You know, it is going to be hard to imagine a scenario, especially after Democrats did have such a strong night at the House level. They are pretty comfortably, it seems like, going to take back the House majority. It's hard to see her getting dethroned. I don't think she's going to be around for long. I think she's probably going to have one term as Speaker.
But one term puts you in 2020.
And, you know, if she were to lose or not to get enough support, we did see the Congressional Black Caucus gain, I believe, 4 seats tonight. The Congressional Black Caucus absolutely loves Jim Clyburn. They have pretty aggressively demanded that an African-American be at least in the top 2 positions in the House. That could put him in a power struggle with Steny Hoyer, who is currently the number 2 Democrat. So yeah, the first thing I think a lot of folks are going to turn to in the next few weeks in South Carolina and in Democratic politics is going to be that speaker's race and whether or not Jim Clyburn can get a major spot in Democratic leadership.
Wow. So we have plenty to keep our eye on. Again, that race, of course, in the first congressional district, then of course talking about the speaker's race still on the horizon. And before we get out of this, I know, I really appreciate you guys having your time. We're dragging through here at quarter and midnight.
With a brown liquor.
But one of the biggest...
brown liquor.
Some of us are drinking brown liquor. Some of us are drinking clear liquor. Some of us are just enjoying
South
company here.
Some of us are still working, guys.
Yes, Meg, thank
Shout
you.
Shout out Senator Gibson.
But the biggest surprise, and maybe not because we've been covering this leading up to it, was the state superintendent of education, the constitutional amendment to make that position appointed rather than elected by the people. I was on with Superintendent Molly Spearman. We were doing our live coverage on SCE TV. And, you know, right now the latest numbers say 58% voted against that to 41% saying that they wanted that position to be appointed. So it was a stunning defeat to us who've been following this, but maybe not so much to the people that have been trying to make this work. I mean, this has been decades in the making.
It has.
Every governor,
15
Republican,
years,
Democrat, have won this.
Sanford, Haley, McMaster have all been pushing this. They finally got on the ballot at the very last minute. It was pretty haphazard process at the end of this session to get it on the ballot in the first place.
Yeah.
But it was surprising, despite all that effort, there was a very, very minimal campaign to support this
Educate
referendum.
People about it.
It seemed like folks assumed that based on past referendum results in South Carolina voters have historically just voted yes on referendums. But, you know, as I was talking to Senator Shaheen last week, and he was saying, folks think very differently about positions like adjutant general, a military position, which we did vote to appoint 4 years ago, than they do a superintendent, which is an education position.
They're like, wait a minute, what am I doing?
We culturally expect to appoint a superintendent of education, and even though, you know, several states already do not, and, you know, if there had been a serious, well-funded campaign behind this referendum, I think, you know, strategists still believe it could have happened, but it was way too little, way too late, you know, and so even though you had former superintendents of both parties supporting this, the message just wasn't out, and in a crowded campaign, you know, that message did not get in front of
voters. And I would love, and I can't wait to catch up with some people with the Haley campaign, because I know this was a top priority of her, and then, you know, of course, she was gone before this happened, and this bill, which required 2/3 majority of both the House and the Senate to even get on the ballot, passed the last day, sine die, of this past session, and here we are, that it just failed.
And, you know, Molly Spearman, Superintendent Spearman, who had supported this, you know, did say about a week and a half ago, that she hopes that if it fails, it would be on the ballot in future elections. That may have been an indication that she already kind of knew this probably
may have had
was
an idea,
pass
right?
That.
Make any takeaways on that?
I mean, I've heard from, like Jamie, folks on both sides of the aisle that are saying, you know what, this is something that we really had at one point argued very hard for.
Yeah.
And maybe, speaking ahead of Election Day a couple days ago, saying if it doesn't pass, then that's on us, that we really didn't do a good enough job telling people why we feel that this is important.
People had no idea.
I heard from some voters today and some folks who voted earlier a couple days ago telling me that, you know, they really kind of weren't sure. They were on the fence, indicating that maybe if somebody had made a strong argument to them one way or the other, they could have been swayed. So who knows if we'll see this come up again, but it didn't work this time.
Yeah, and again, our session starts in January, so we're going to see if that works its way through. But again, it took, I mean, my experience was telling me, in the 60s, I mean, they've been trying to do this. Would have given the governor the ability to really push his own education priorities through. Now, and again, these are separate positions. So we'll see what happens in January. I'm sure there'll be a bill pre-filed like they have always been. So again, it is 11:45. We're wrapping up our mini pod here. The latest results you have, Meg has not given us any AP race call for the first congressional, so
you might know when you wake up,
but we gave you the latest we had available to us here from the Republican Party Watch Party in Columbia, joined by Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Meg Kinnard with the Associated Press. Guys, thank you so much for joining me on this mini pod recapping the midterm elections.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, that's good.
play me out, Marvin. Play me out.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV every Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, where you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our sweet memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message or slide into our DMs, as we say, on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media consultant. Tom Posey is our executive producer. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
We mentioned we're drinking brown liquor.
Yeah, wait. Can we talk about the fact that I have brown liquor and you have clear liquor?
Or as you would say, white liquor.
Are you even in South Carolina?
Okay.
Brown liquor.